Yours truly, Catherine O'Riordan, Assistant Librarian. Hoppy O'Halloran is the only master in Leamy's National School who ever sits. That's because he's the headmaster, or because he has to rest himself from the twisting walk that comes from the short leg. The other masters walk back and forth in the front of the room or up and down the aisles, and you never know when you get a whack of a cane or a slap of a strap for giving the wrong answer or writing something sloppy. If Hoppy wants to do anything to you, he calls you to the front of the room to punish you before three classes. There are good days when he sits at the desk and talks about America. He says, "My boys, from the frozen wastes of North Dakota to the fragrant orange groves of Florida, Americans enjoy all climates." He talks about American history. "If the American farmer with flintlock and musket could wrest from the English a continent, surely we, warriors ever, can recover our island." If we don't want him tormenting us with algebra or Irish grammar, all we have to do is ask him a question about America, and that gets him so excited he might go on for the whole day. He sits at his desk and recites the tribes and chiefs he loves: Arapaho, Cheyenne, Chippewa, Sioux, Apache, Iroquois. "Poetry, my boys, poetry. And listen to the chiefs: Kicking Bear, Rain in the Face, Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and the genius, Geronimo." In seventh class, he hands out a small book, a poem that goes on for pages and pages, "The Deserted Village" by Oliver Goldsmith. He says that this seems to be a poem about England, but it's a lament for the poet's native land, our own native land, Ireland. We are to get this poem by heart, 20 lines a night to be recited every morning. Six boys are called to the front of the room for reciting, and if you miss a line, you are slapped twice in each hand. He tells us, "Put the books under the desks," and the whole class chants the passage on the schoolmaster in the village. "Beside yon straggling fence that skirts the way, with blossom furs unprofitably gay, there in his noisy mansion skilled to rule, the village master taught his little school. A man severe he was, and stern to view. I knew him well, and every truant knew. Full well the boding tremblers learned to trace the day's disasters in his morning face. Full well they laughed with counterfeited glee at all his jokes, for many a joke had he. Full well the busy whisper circling round conveyed the dismal tidings when he frowned." He always closes his eyes and smiles when we reach the last lines of the passage. "Yet he was kind, or if severe in aught, the love he bore to learning was in fault. The village all declared how much he knew. 'Twas certain he could write and cipher too. Lands he could measure, terms and tides presage, and even the story ran that he could gauge. In arguing too the parson owned his skill, for e'en though vanquished he could argue still, while words of learned length and thundering sound amazed the gazing rustics ranged around. And still they gazed, and still the wonder grew, that one small head could carry all he knew." We know he loves these lines because they're about his schoolmaster, about him. And he's right, because we wonder how one small head could carry all he knows, and we'll remember him in these lines. He says, "Ah, boys, boys, you can make up your own minds, but first stock them. Are you listening to me? Stock your minds, and you can move through the world resplendent. Clark, define resplendent." "I think it's shining, sir." "Pithy, Clark, but adequate. McCourt, and give us a sentence with pithy." "Clark is pithy, but adequate, sir." "Adroit, McCourt. You have a mind for the priesthood, my boy, or politics. Think of that." "I will, sir." Tell your mother come and see me. I will, sir. Mam says, No, I could never go near Mr. O'Halloran. I don't have a decent dress or a proper coat. What does he want to see me for? I don't know. Well, ask him. I can't. He'll kill me. If he says bring your mother, you have to bring your mother or out comes the stick. She comes to see him, and he talks to her in the hallway. He tells her that her son Frank must continue school.
He must not fall into the messenger boy trap. That leads nowhere. Take him up to the Christian Brothers, tell them I sent you. Tell them he's a bright boy and ought to be going to secondary school and beyond that, university.
He tells her he did not become headmaster of Leamy's National School to preside over an academy of messenger boys. Mam says, Thank you, Mr. O'Halloran. I wish Mr. O'Halloran would mind his own business. I don't want to go to the Christian Brothers. I want to quit school forever and get a job, get my wages every Friday, go to the pictures on Saturday nights like everyone. A few days later, Mam tells me, give my face and hands a good wash. We're going to the Christian Brothers. I tell her, I don't want to go. I want to work. I want to be a man. She tells me, stop the whining. I'm going to secondary school and we'll all manage somehow. I'm going to school if she has to scrub floors and she'll practice on my face. She knocks on the door of the Christian Brothers and says she wants to see the superior, Brother Murray. He comes to the door, looks at my mother and me and says, What? Mam says, This is my son, Frank. Mr. O'Halloran at Leamy's says he's bright and would there be any chance of getting him in here for secondary school? We don't have room for him, says Brother Murray, and closes the door in our faces. Mam turns away from the door, and it's a long, silent walk home. She takes off her coat, makes tea, sits by the fire. Listen to me, she says. Are you listening? I am. That's the second time a door was slammed in your face by the church. Is it? I don't remember. Stephen Carey told you and your father you couldn't be an altar boy and closed the door in your face. Do you remember that?
I do.
And now Brother Murray slams the door in your face?
I don't mind. I want to get a job.
Her face tightens, and she's angry. You are never to let anybody slam the door in your face again. Do you hear me? She starts to cry by the fire.
Oh, God, I didn't bring ye into the world to be a family of messenger boys.
I don't know what to do or say. I'm so relieved I don't have to stay in school for 5 or 6 more years. I'm free! I'm 13, going on 14, and it's June, the last month of school forever. Mam takes me to see the priest, Dr. Cowper, about getting a job as a telegram boy. The supervisor in the post office, Mrs. O'Connell, says, Do you know how to cycle? And I lied that I do. She says I can't start till I'm 14, so come back in August. Mr. O'Halloran tells the class it's a disgrace that boys like McCourt, Clark, Kennedy have to hew wood and draw water. He's disgusted by this free and independent Ireland that keeps a class system foisted on us by the English, that we are throwing our talented children on the dung heap. You must get out of this country, boys. Go to America, McCourt. Do you hear me?
I do, sir.
Priests come to the school to recruit us for the foreign missions. Redemptorists, Franciscans, Holy Ghost Fathers, all converting the distant heathen. I ignore them. I'm going to America. Till one priest catches my attention. He says he comes from the Order of the White Fathers, missionaries to the nomadic Bedouin tribes, and chaplains to the French Foreign Legion. I ask for the application. I'll need a letter from the parish priest and a physical examination by my family doctor. The parish priest writes the letter on the spot. He would have been glad to see me go last year. The doctor says,
What's this?
That's an application to join the White Fathers, missionaries to the nomadic tribes of the Sahara, and chaplains to the French Foreign Legion.
Oh, yeah? French Foreign Legion, is it? Do you know the preferred form of transportation in the Sahara Desert?
Trains?
No, it's the camel. Do you know what a camel is?
It has a hump.
It has more than a hump. It has a nasty, mean disposition, and its teeth are green with gangrene, and it bites. Do you know where it bites?
In the Sahara?
No, you Amadon. It bites your shoulder, rips it right off, leaves you standing there, tilted in the Sahara. How would you like that, huh? And what class of a spectacle you'd be, strolling down the street, lopsided in Limerick? What girl in her right mind would look at an ex-white father with one miserable scrawny shoulder? Look at your eyes. They're bad enough here in Limerick. In the Sahara, they'll fester and rot and fall out of your head. How old are you?
13.
Go home to your mother.
It's not our house, and we don't feel free in it the way we did in Roden Lane, up in Italy or down in Ireland. When Lama comes home, he wants to read in his bed or sleep, and we have to be quiet. We stay in the streets till after dark, and when we come inside, there's nothing to do but go to bed and read a book if we have a candle or paraffin oil for the lamp. Mam tells us to go to bed. She'll be after us in a minute as soon as she climbs to the loft with Lamon's last mug of tea. We often fall asleep before she goes up, but there are nights when we hear them talking, grunting, moaning. There are nights when she never comes down, and Michael and Alfie have the big bed to themselves. Maliki says she stays up there because it's too hard for her to climb down in the dark. He's only 12, and he doesn't understand. I'm 13. And I think they're at the excitement up there. I know about the excitement, and I know it's a sin, but how can it be a sin if it comes to me in a dream where American girls pose in swimming suits on the screen at the Lyric Cinema, and I wake up pushing and pumping? It's a sin when you're wide awake and going at yourself, the way the boys talked about it in Leamy's schoolyard after Mr. O'Dea roared the sixth commandment at us, "Thou shalt not commit adultery," which means impure thoughts, impure words, impure deeds, and that's what adultery is, dirty things in general. One redemptorist priest barks at us all the time about the sixth commandment. He says impurity is so grave a sin, the Virgin Mary turns her face away and weeps. And why does she weep, boys? She weeps because of you and what you are doing to her beloved son. She weeps when she looks down the long, dreary vista of time and beholds in horror the spectacle of Limerick boys defiling themselves, polluting themselves, interfering with themselves, abusing themselves, soiling their young bodies, which are the temples of the Holy Ghost. Our Lady weeps over these abominations, knowing that every time you interfere with yourself, you nailed to the cross her beloved son, that once more you hammer into his dear head the crown of thorns, that you reopen those ghastly wounds. In an agony of thirst he hangs on the cross, and what is he offered by those perfidious Romans? A lavatory sponge plunged into vinegar and gall and thrust into his poor mouth, a mouth that moves rarely except to pray. To pray, even for you boys, even for you who nailed him to that cross. Consider our Lord's suffering. Consider the crown of thorns. Consider a small pin driven into your skull, the agony of the piercing. Consider then 20 thorns driven into your head. Reflect. Meditate on the nails tearing his hands, his feet. Could you endure a fraction of that agony? Take that pin again, that mere pin. Force it into your side. Enlarge that sensation 100-fold
and you are penetrated by that awful lance. Oh, boys, the devil wants your souls. He wants you with him in hell. And know this, that every time you interfere with yourself, every time you succumb to the vile sin of self-abuse, you not only nail Christ to the cross, you take another step closer to hell itself. Retreat from the abyss, boys. Resist the devil and keep your hands to yourself.
I can't stop interfering with myself. I pray to the Virgin Mary and tell her I'm sorry I put her son back on the cross, and I'll never do it again. But I can't help myself, and I swear I'll go to confession, and after that, surely after that, I'll never do it again. I don't want to go to hell with devils chasing me for eternity, jabbing me with hot pitchforks. The priests of Limerick have no patience with the likes of me. I go to confession, and they hiss that I'm not in a proper spirit of repentance, that if I were, I'd give up this hideous sin. I go from church to church, looking for an easy priest, till Paddy Clossy tells me there's one in the Dominican church who's 90 years old and deaf as a turnip. Every few weeks, the old priest hears my confession and mumbles that I should pray for him. Sometimes he falls asleep, and I don't have the heart to wake him up, so I go to communion the next day without penance or absolution. It's not my fault if priests fall asleep on me. And surely I'm in a state of grace just for going to confession. Then one day, the little panel in the confession box slides back, and it's not my man at all. It's a young priest with a big ear like a seashell. He'll surely hear everything. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It's a fortnight since my last confession.
And what have you done since then, my child?
I hit my brother. I went on the mooch from school. I lied to my mother.
Yes, my child, and what else?
I did dirty things, Father.
Ah, my child. Was that with yourself, or with another, or with some class of beast?
Some class of beast? I never heard of a sin like that before. This priest must be from the country, and if he is, he's opening up new worlds to me.
The night before I'm to go to Killaloe, Lamon Griffin comes home drunk and eats a great bag of fish and chips at the table. He tells Mam boil water for tea, and when she says she has no coal or turf, he yells at her and calls her a great lump, living free under his roof with her pack of brats. He throws money at me to go to the shop for a few sods of turf and wood for kindling. I don't want to go. I want to hit him for the way he treats my mother, but if I say anything, he won't let me have the bicycle tomorrow after I've waited 3 weeks. When Mam gets the fire going and boils the water, I remind him of his promise to loan me the bike.
Did you empty my chamber pot today?
I forgot. I'll do it this minute.
He shouts, "You didn't empty my damn chamber pot? I promise you the bike. I give you tuppence a week to run messages for me and empty the chamber pot, and you stand there with your thick gob hanging out and tell me you didn't do it."
I'm sorry, I forgot. I'll do it now.
You will you? And how do you think you'll get up to the loft? Are you going to pull the table out from under my fish and chips?
Mam says, sure, he was at school all day, and he had to go to the doctor for his eyes.
Well, you can bloody well forget about the bicycle. You didn't live up to the bargain.
But he couldn't do it, says Mam. He tells her shut up and mind her own business, and she goes quiet by the fire. He goes back to his fish and chips, but I tell him again, you promised me. I emptied that chamber pot and did your messages for 3 weeks.
Shut up and go to bed.
You can't tell me to go to bed. You're not my father, and you promised me.
I'm telling you, as sure as God made little apples,
that if I get up from this table, you'll be calling for your patron saint.
You promise me.
He pushes the chair back from the table. He stumbles towards me and sticks his finger between my eyes.
I'm telling you, shut your gob, scabby eyes.
I won't. You promise me.
He punches my shoulders, and when I won't stop, moves to my head. My mother jumps up crying and tries to pull him away. He punches and kicks me into the bedroom, but I keep saying,
you promise me.
He knocks me to my mother's bed and punches till I cover my face and head with my arms.
I'll kill you, you little shit.
Mam is screaming and pulling at him till he falls backward into the kitchen. She says,
come on, oh, come on. Eat your fish and chips. He's only a child. He'll get over it.
I hear him go back to his chair and pull it to the table. I hear him snuffle and slurp when he eats and drinks.
Hand me the matches, he says. By Jesus, I need a fag after that.
There's a put-put song when he puffs on the cigarette and a whimper from my mother. He says,
I'm going to bed.
And with the drink in him, it takes him a while to climb the chair to the table, pull up the chair, climb to the loft. The bed squeaks under him, and he grunts when he pulls off his boots and drops them to the floor. I can hear Mam crying when she blows into the globe of the paraffin oil lamp and everything goes dark. After what happened, she'll surely want to get into her own bed, and I'm ready to go to the small one against the wall. Instead, there's the sound of her climbing the chair, the table, the chair, crying up into the loft and telling Lemon Griffin,
he's only a boy, tormented with his eyes.
And when Lemon says,
he's a little shit and I want him out of the house,
she cries and begs till there's whispering and grunting and moaning and nothing. In a while, they're snoring in the loft and my brothers are asleep around me. I can't stay in this house, for if Lemon Griffin comes at me again, I'll take a knife to his neck. I don't know what to do or where to go. I leave the house and follow the streets from the Sarsfield Barracks to the Monument Cafe. I dream of how I'll get back at Lemon someday. I'll go to America and see Joe Lewis. I'll tell him my troubles, and he'll understand because he comes from a poor family. He'll show me how to build up my muscles, how to hold my hands and use my feet. He'll show me how to dig my chin into my shoulder the way he does and how to let go with the right uppercut that will send Lemon flying. I'll drag Lemon to the graveyard at Mungret where his family and Mam's family are buried, and I'll cover him with earth all the way to his chin so that he won't be able to move and he'll beg for his life, and I'll say, end of the road, Lemon. You're going to meet your maker. And he'll beg and beg while I trickle dirt in his face till it's covered completely and he's gasping and asking God for forgiveness for not giving me the bike and punching me all over the house and doing the excitement with my mother. And I'll be laughing away because he's not in the state of grace after the excitement and he's gone to hell as sure as God made little apples, as he used to say himself. The streets are dark, and I have to keep an eye out in case I might be lucky like Malachi long ago and find fish and chips dropped by drunken soldiers. There's nothing on the ground. If I find my uncle, Ab Sheehan, he might give me some of his Friday night fish and chips. But they tell me in the cafe he came and went already. I'm 13 now, so I don't call him Uncle Pat anymore. I call him Ab or the Abbot like everybody else. Surely if I go to Grandma's house, he'll give me a piece of bread or something. Maybe he'll let me stay the night. I can tell him I'll be working in a few weeks, delivering telegrams and getting big tips at the post office and ready to pay my own way. He's sitting up in bed, finishing his fish and chips, dropping to the floor the limerick leader they were wrapped in, wiping his mouth and hands with the blanket. He looks at me.
That face is all swole. Did you fall on that face?
I tell him I did, because there's no use telling him anything else. He wouldn't understand. He says,
you could stay in me mother's bed tonight. You can't walk the streets with that face and them two red eyes in your head.
He says there's no food in the house, not a scrap of bread, and when he falls asleep, I take the greasy newspaper from the floor. I lick the front page, which is all advertisements for films and dances in the city. I licked the headlines. I licked the great attacks of Patton and Montgomery in France and Germany. I licked the war in the Pacific. I licked the obituaries and the sad memorial poems, the sports pages, the market prices of eggs, butter and bacon. I sucked the paper till there isn't a smidgen of grease. I wonder what I'll do tomorrow. In the morning, the abbot gives me the money to go to Kathleen O'Connell's for bread, margarine, tea, milk. He boils water on the gas ring and tells me I can have a mug of tea and, go easy with the sugar, I'm not a millionaire. You can have a cut of bread, but don't make it too thick. It's July, and school is over forever. In a few weeks I'll be delivering telegrams at the post office, working like a man. In the weeks I'm idle, I can do anything I like. Get up in the morning, stay in bed, take long walks out the country like my father, wander around Limerick. If I had the money, I'd go over to the Lyric Cinema, eat sweets, see Errol Flynn conquering everyone in sight. I can read the English and Irish papers the abbot brings home, or I can use the library cards of Lemon Griffin and my mother till I'm found out. Mam sends Michael with a milk bottle of warm tea, a few cuts of bread smeared with dripping, a note to say Lemon Griffin isn't angry anymore, and I can come back. Michael says, "You coming home, Frankie?" "No." "Ah, do, Frankie, come on." I live here now. I'm never going back. "But Maliki is gone to the army, and you're here, and I have no big brother. All the boys have big brothers, and I only have Alfie. He's not even 4, and he can't talk right." "I can't go back. I'm never going back. You can come here any time you like." His eyes glint with tears. That gives me such pain in my heart, I want to say, "All right, I'll come with you." I'm only saying that. I know I'll never be up to face Lemon Griffin again, and I don't know if I can look at my mother. I watch Michael go up the lane, with the sole of his shoe broken and clacking along the pavement. When I start that job at the post office, I'll buy him shoes, so I will. I'll give him an egg and take him to the Lyric Cinema for the film and the sweets, and then we go to Nocton's and eat fish and chips till our bellies are sticking out a mile. I'll get money someday for a house or a flat with electric light and a lavatory and beds with sheets, pillows, blankets like the rest of the world. We'll have breakfast in a bright kitchen with flowers dancing in the garden beyond, delicate cups and saucers, egg cups, eggs soft in the yolk and ready to melt the rich creamy butter, a teapot with a cozy on it, toast with butter and marmalade galore. We'll take our time and listen to music from the BBC or the American Armed Forces Network. I'll buy proper clothes for the whole family so our arses won't be hanging out of our pants, and we won't have the shame. The thought of the shame brings a pain in my heart and starts me sniffling. The abbot says, "What's up with you? Didn't you have your bread? Didn't you have your tea? What more do you want? 'Tis an egg you'll be looking for next." There's no use talking to someone who was dropped in his head and sells papers for a living. He complains he can't be feeding me forever and I'll have to get my own bread and tea. He doesn't want to come home and find me reading in the kitchen with the electric light bulb blazing away. He can read numbers, so he can. And when he goes out to sell papers, he reads the electric meter so he'll know how much I use. And if I don't stop turning on that light, he'll take the fuse out and carry it in his pocket. And if I put in another fuse, he'll have the electricity pulled out altogether and go back to gas, which was good enough for his poor dead mother, and will surely suit him, for all he does is sit up in the bed to eat his fish and chips and count his money before he goes to sleep. I get up early like Dad and go on long walks into the country. I walk around the graveyard in the old abbey at Mungret, where my mother's relations are buried, and I go up the Boreen to the Norman castle at Carrigogunnell, where Dad brought me twice. I climb to the top and Ireland is spread out before me. The Shannon is shining its way to the Atlantic. Dad told me this castle was built hundreds of years ago, and if you wait for the larks to stop their singing over there, you can hear the Normans below hammering and talking and getting ready for battle. Once he brought me here in the dark, so that we could hear Norman and Irish voices down through the centuries, and I heard them. I did. Sometimes I'm up there alone on the heights of Carrigogunnel, and there are voices of Norman girls from olden times laughing and singing in French. And when I see them in my mind, I'm tempted, and I climb to the very top of the castle where once there was a tower, and there in full view of Ireland I interfere with myself and spurt all over Carrigogunnel and fields beyond. That's a sin I could never tell a priest. Climbing to great heights and going at yourself before all of Ireland is surely worse than doing it in a private place with yourself, or with another, or with some class of a beast. Somewhere down there in the fields or along the banks of the Shannon, a boy or a milkmaid might have looked up and seen me in my sin, and if they did, I'm doomed, because the priests are always saying that anyone who exposes a child to sin will have a millstone tied around his neck and be cast into the sea. Still, the thought of someone watching me brings on the excitement again. I wouldn't want the small boy to be watching me, no. That would surely lead to the millstone, but if there was a milkmaid gawking up, surely she'd get excited and go at herself, though I don't know if girls can go at themselves when they don't have anything to go at. No equipment, Mikey Malloy used to say. I wished that old deaf Dominican priest would come back so that I could tell him my troubles with the excitement, but he's dead now, and I'll have to face a priest who'll go on about the millstone and the doom. Doom. That's the favourite word of every priest in Limerick. I walk back along O'Connell Avenue in Ballinacorra, where people have their bread and milk delivered early to their doorsteps. And surely there's no harm if I borrow a loaf or a bottle with every intention of giving it back when I get my job at the post office. I'm not stealing, I'm borrowing. That's not a mortal sin. Besides, I stood on top of a castle this morning and committed a sin far worse than stealing bread and milk. And if you commit one sin, you might as well commit a few more, because you get the same sentence in hell. One sin, eternity. A dozen sins, eternity. Might as well be hung for a sheep as a lamb, as my mother would say. I drink the odd pint of milk and leave the bottle, so that the milkman won't be blamed for not delivering. I like milkmen, because one of them gave me 2 broken eggs, which I swallowed raw with bits of shell and all. He said I'd grow up powerful if I had nothing else but 2 eggs and a pint of porter every day. Everything you need is in the egg, and everything you want is in the pint. Some houses get better bread than others. It costs more, and that's what I take. I feel sorry for the rich people who get up in the morning and go to the door and find their bread missing, but I can't let myself starve to death. If I starve, I'll never have the strength for my telegram boy job at the post office, which means I'll have no money to put back all that bread and milk and no way of saving to go to America. And if I can't go to America, I might as well jump into the River Shannon. It's only a few weeks till I get my first wages in the post office, and surely these rich people won't collapse with the hunger till then. They can always send the maid out for more. That's the difference between the poor and the rich. The poor can't send out for more because there's no money to send out for more. And if there was, they wouldn't have a maid to send. It's the maids I have to worry about. I have to be careful when I borrow the milk and the bread, and they're at the front doors polishing knobs, knockers and letter boxes. If they see me, they'll be running to the woman of the house.
Oh, madam, madam, there's an urchin beyond that's making off with all the milk and bread.
Beyond. Maids talk like that because they're all from the country. Mullingar heifers, says Paddy Clossie's uncle, beef to the heels, and they wouldn't give you the steam of their piss. I bring home the bread, and even if the abbot is surprised, he doesn't say, "Where did you get it?" Because he was dropped in his head, and that knocks the curiosity out of you. He just looks at me with his big eyes that are blue in the middle and yellow all around, and slurps his tea from the great cracked mug his mother left behind. He tells me, "That's me mug, and don't be drinking your tea, Aushavish." Aushavish. That's the Limerick slum talk that always worried Dad. He said, "I don't want my sons growing up in a Limerick lane saying, Aushavish, it's common and low class. Say, out of it, properly. And Mam said, I hope it keeps fine for you, but you're not doing much to get us Auschwitz. Out beyond Ballinacurra, I climb orchard walls for apples. If there's a dog, I move on, because I don't have Paddy Clossy's way of talking to them. Farmers come at me, but they're always slow in their rubber boots, and even if they jump on a bicycle to chase me, I jump over walls where they can't take a bike. The abbot knows where I got the apples. If you grow up in the lanes of Limerick, you're bound to rob the odd orchard sooner or later. Even if you hate apples, you have to rob orchards, or your pals will say you're a sissy. I always offer the abbot an apple, but he won't eat it because of the scarcity of teeth that he's had. He has 5 left, and he won't risk leaving them in an apple. If I cut the apple into slices, he still won't eat it because that's not the proper way to eat an apple. That's what he says. And if I say, you slice bread before you eat it, don't you? He says, apples is apples and bread is bread. That's how you talk when you're dropped on your head. Michael comes again with warm tea and a milk bottle and 2 cuts of fried bread. I tell him I don't need it anymore. Tell ma'am I'm taking care of myself and I don't need her tea and fried bread, thank you very much. Michael is delighted when I give him an apple, and I tell him come every second day and he can have more. That stops him from asking me to go back to Lamb and Griffin's, and I'm glad it stops his tears. There's a market down in Irishtown where the farmers come on Saturdays with their vegetables, hens, eggs, butter. If I'm there early, they'll give me a few pennies for helping unload their carts or motor cars. At the end of the day, they'll give me vegetables they can't sell. Anything crushed, bruised, or rotten in parts. One farmer's wife always gives me cracked eggs and tells me, fry them eggs tomorrow when you come back from Mass in a state of grace, for if you ate them eggs with the sin on your soul, they'll stick in your gullet, so they will. She's a farmer's wife, and that's how they talk. I'm not much better than a beggar now myself, the way I stand at the doors of fish and chip shops when they're closing, in hopes they might have burnt chips left over or bits of fish floating around in the grease. If they're in a hurry, the shop owners will give me the chips and a sheet of paper for wrapping. The paper I like is the News of the World. It's banned in Ireland, but people sneak it in from England for the shocking pictures of girls in swimming suits that are almost not there. Then there are stories of people committing all kinds of sins you wouldn't find in Limerick, getting divorces, committing adultery. Adultery. I still have to find out what that word means. Look it up in the library. I'm sure it's worse than what the masters taught us. Bad thoughts, bad words, bad deeds. I take my chips home and get into bed like the abbot. If he has a few pints taken, he sits up eating his chips from the Limerick Leader and singing The Road to Rasheen. I eat my chips, I lick the News of the World, I lick the stories about people doing shocking things, I lick the girls in their bathing suits, and when there's nothing left to lick, I look at the girls till the abbot blows out the light, and I'm committing a mortal sin under the blanket. I can go to the library any time with Mam's card or Lemon Griffin's. I'll never be caught because Lamon is too lazy to get out of bed on a Saturday, and Mam will never go near a library with the shame of her clothes. Miss O'Riordan smiles.
The lives of the saints are waiting for you, Frank. Volumes and volumes. Butler, O'Hanlon, Baring Gould. I've told the head librarian all about you, and she's so pleased she's ready to give you your own grown-up card. Isn't that wonderful?
Thanks, Miss O'Riordan. I'm reading all about St. Brigid, Virgin, February 1st. She was so beautiful that men from all over Ireland panted to marry her, and her father wanted her to marry someone important. She didn't want to marry anyone, so she prayed to God for help, and he caused her eye to melt in her head so that it dribbled down her cheek and left such a great welt, the men of Ireland lost interest. Then there's St. Wilga Fortes, Virgin Martyr, July 20th. Her mother had 9 children, all at the same time. 4 sets of twins, and Wilga Fortes, the odd one, all winding up martyrs for the faith. Wilgefortis was beautiful, and her father wanted to marry her off to the king of Sicily. Wilgefortis was desperate, and God helped her by allowing a beard and a moustache to grow on her face, which made the king of Sicily think twice, but sent her father into such a rage, he had her crucified, beard and all. St. Wilgefortis is the one you pray to if you're an Englishwoman with a troublesome husband. The priests never tell us about virgin martyrs like St. Agatha, February 5th. February is a powerful month for virgin martyrs. Sicilian pagans ordered Agatha to give up her faith in Jesus. And like all the virgin martyrs, she said, nay. They tortured her, stretched her on the rack, tore her sides with iron hooks, burned her with blazing torches, and she said, nay, I will not deny our Lord. They crushed her breasts and cut them off, but when they rolled her over hot coals, it was more than she could bear, so she expired, giving praise. Virgin martyrs always died singing hymns and giving praise, not minding one bit if lions tore big chunks from their sides and gobbled them on the spot. How is it the priest never told us about St. Ursula and her 11,000 maiden martyrs, October the 21st? Her father wanted her to marry a pagan king, but she said, I'll go away for a while, 3 years, and think about it. So off she goes with her 1,000 noble ladies-in-waiting and their companions, 10,000. They sailed around for a while and traipsed through various countries till they stopped in Cologne, where the chief of the Huns asked Ursula to marry him. Nay, she said, and the Huns killed her and the maidens with her. Why couldn't she say yes and save the lives of 11,000 virgins? Why did virgin martyrs have to be so stubborn? I like St. Mawling, an Irish bishop. He didn't live in a palace like the Bishop of Limerick. He lived in a tree, and when other saints visited him for dinner, they'd sit around in branches like birds having a grand time with their water and dry bread. He was walking along one day and a leper said, Hi, St. Mawling, where are you going? I'm going to Mass, said St. Mawling. Well, I'd like to go to Mass too, so why don't you hoist me up on your back and carry me? St. Mawling did, but he no sooner had the leper up on his back than the leper started to complain. Your hair shirt, he said, is hard on my sores. Take it off. St. Mawling took off the shirt and off they went again. Then the leper says, I need to blow my nose. St. Mawling says, I don't have any class of a handkerchief. Use your hand. The leper says, I can't hold on to you and blow my nose at the same time. All right, says St. Mawling, you can blow into my hand. That won't do, says the leper. I barely have a hand left with the leprosy, and I can't hold on and blow into your hand. If you were a proper saint, you'd twist around here and suck the stuff out of my head. St. Mawling didn't want to suck the leper's snot, but he did, and offered it up, and praise God for the privilege. I could understand my father sucking the bad stuff out of Michael's head when he was a baby and desperate, but I don't understand why God wanted St. Mawling to go around sucking the snot out of lepers' heads. I don't understand God at all. And even if I'd like to be a saint and have everyone adore me, I'd never suck the snot of a leper. I'd like to be a saint, but if that's what you have to do, I think I'll stay the way I am. Still, I'm ready to spend my life in this library reading about virgins and virgin martyrs, till I get into trouble with Miss O'Riordan over a book someone left on the table. The author is Lin Yutang. Anyone can tell this is a Chinese name, and I'm curious to know what the Chinese talk about. It's a book of essays about love and the body, and one of his words sends me to the dictionary. Turgid. He says, the male organ of copulation becomes turgid and is inserted into the receptive female orifice. Turgid. The dictionary says swollen, and that's what I am, standing there looking at the dictionary, because I know now what Mikey Malloy was talking about all along, that we're no different from the dogs that get stuck in each other in the streets, and it's shocking to think of all the mothers and fathers doing the likes of this. My father lied to me for years about the angel on the seventh step. Miss O'Riordan wants to know what word I'm looking for. She always looks worried when I'm at the dictionary, so I tell her I'm looking for canonize or beatific or any class of a religious word. And what's this? She says. This is not the lives of the saints. She picks up Lin Yutang and starts reading the page where I left the book face down on the table.
Mother of God, is this what you were reading? I saw this in your hand.
Well, I only wanted to see if the Chinese had any saints.
Oh, indeed you did. This is disgraceful. Filth. No wonder the Chinese are the way they are. But what could you expect of slanty eyes and yellow skin? And you, now that I look at you, have a bit of the slanty eye yourself. You are to leave this library at once.
But I'm reading the lives of the saints.
Out! Or I'll call the head librarian and she'll have the guards on you. Out! You should be running to the priest and confessing your sins. Out! And before you go, hand me the library cards of your poor mother and Mr. Griffin. I have a good mind to write to your poor mother, and I would if I thought it wouldn't destroy her entirely. Lin Yutang, indeed. Out!
There's no use talking to librarians when they're in that state. You could stand there for an hour telling them all you've read about Bridget and Wilgefortis and Agatha and Ursula and the Maiden Martyrs, but all they think about is one word on one page of Lin Yutang. The People's Park is behind the library. It's a sunny day, the grass is dry, and I'm worn out begging for chips and putting up with librarians who get into a state over turgid. And I'm looking at the clouds drifting above the monument and drifting off myself all turgid till I'm having a dream about virgin martyrs in bathing suits in the news of the world pelting Chinese writers with sheep's bladders, and I wake up in a state of excitement with something hot and sticky pumping out of me. Oh God, my male organ of copulation sticking out a mile, people in the park giving me curious looks, and mothers telling their children, come over here, love, come away from that fella, someone should call the guards on him.
The day before my 14th birthday, I see myself in the glass in Grandma's sideboard. The way I look, how can I ever start my job at the post office? Everything is torn, shirt, gansy, short pants, stockings. My shoes are ready to fall off my feet entirely. Relics of all decency, my mother would call them. If my clothes are bad, I'm worse. No matter how I drench my hair under the tap, it sticks out in all directions. The best cure for standing up hair is spit. Only it's hard to spit on your own head. You have to let go with a good one up in the air and duck to catch it on your pole. My eyes are red and oozing yellow. There are matching red and yellow pimples all over my face, and my front teeth are so black with rot, I'll never be able to smile in my life. I have no shoulders, and I know the whole world admires shoulders. When a man dies in Limerick, the women always say, "Grand man he was. Shoulders that big and wide, he wouldn't come in the door for you, had to come in sideways." When I die, they'll say, "Poor little devil, died without a sign of his shoulder." I wish I had some sign of his shoulder so that people would know I was at least 14 years of age. All the boys in Leamy's had shoulders except for Fintan Slattery, and I don't want to be like him with no shoulders and knees worn away from prayer. If I had any money left, I'd light a candle to St. Francis and ask him if there's any chance God could be persuaded to perform a miracle on my shoulders. Or, if I had a stamp, I could write to Joe Lewis and say, "Dear Joe, is there any chance you could tell me where you got your powerful shoulders even though you were poor?" I have to look decent for my job, so I take off all my clothes and stand naked in the backyard, washing them under the tap with a bar of carbolic soap. I hang them on Grandma's clothesline, shirt, gansy, pants, stockings, and pray to God it won't rain. Pray they'll be dry for tomorrow, which is the start of my life.
I can't go anywhere in my pelt, so I stay in bed all day reading all newspapers, getting excited with the girls and the news of the world, and thanking God for the drying sun. The abbot comes home at 5 and makes tea downstairs, and even though I'm hungry, I know he'll grumble if I ask him for anything. He knows the one thing that worries me is he might go to Aunt Aggie and complain I'm staying in Grandma's house and sleeping in her bed. And if Aunt Aggie hears that, she'll come over and throw me into the street. He hides the bread when he's finished, and I can never find it. You would think that one who was never dropped in his head would be able to find the hidden bread of one who was dropped in his head. Then I realize, if the bread is not in the house, he must take it with him in the pocket of the overcoat he wears winter and summer. The minute I hear him clumping from the kitchen to the backyard lavatory, I run downstairs, pull the loaf from the pocket, cut off a thick slice, back into the pocket, up the stairs and into the bed. He can never say a word, never accuse me. You'd have to be a thief of the worst class to steal one slice of bread, and no one would ever believe him, not even Aunt Aggie. Besides, she'd bark at him and say, "What are you doing anyway, going around with a loaf of bread in your pocket? That's no place for a loaf of bread." I chewed the bread slowly. One mouthful every 15 minutes will make it last, and if I wash it down with water, the bread would swell in my belly and give me the full feeling. I look out the back window to make sure the evening sun is drying my clothes. Other backyards have lines with clothes that are bright and colourful and dance in the wind. Mine hang from the line like dead dogs. The sun is bright, but it's cold and damp in the house, and I wish I had something to wear in the bed. I have no other clothes, and if I touch anything of the abbot's, he'll surely run to Aunt Aggie. All I can find in the wardrobe is Grandma's old black woolen dress. You're not supposed to wear your grandmother's old dress when she's dead, and you're a boy. But what does it matter if it keeps you warm and you're in bed under the blankets where no one will ever know? The dress has the smell of old dead grandmother, and I worry she might rise from the grave and curse me before the whole family and all assembled. I pray to St. Francis. Ask him to keep her in the grave where she belongs. Promise him a candle when I start my job. Remind him the robe he wore himself wasn't too far from a dress, and no one ever tormented him over it. And fall asleep with the image of his face in my dream. The worst thing in the world is to be sleeping in your dead grandmother's bed, wearing her black dress, when your uncle, the abbot, falls on his arse outside South's pub after a night of drinking pints. And people who can't mind their own business rush to Aunt Aggie's house to tell her, so that she gets Uncle Pat Keating to help her carry the abbot home and upstairs to where you're sleeping, and she barks at you, "What are you doing in this house, in that bed? Get up and put on the kettle for tea for your poor Uncle Pat that fell down." And when you don't move, she pulls the blankets and falls backward like one seeing a ghost and yelling, "Mother of God, what are you doing in me dead mother's dress?" That's the worst thing of all, because it's hard to explain that you're getting ready for the big job in your life, that you washed your clothes, they're drying abroad on the line, and it was so cold you had to wear the only thing you could find in the house. And it's even harder to talk to Aunt Aggie when the abbot is groaning in the bed, "Me feet is like a fire, put water on me feet," and Uncle Pa Keating is covering his mouth with his hand and collapsing against the wall laughing and telling you that you look gorgeous and black suits you, and would you ever straighten your hem? You don't know what to do when Aunt Aggie yells at you, "Get out of that bed and put the kettle on downstairs for tea for your poor uncle." Should you take off the dress and put on a blanket, or should you go as you are? One minute she's screaming, "What are you doing in me poor mother's dress?" The next thing she's telling you, "Put on that bloody kettle." I tell her I wash my clothes for the big job. "What big job?" "Telegram boy at the post office." She says, if the post office is hiring the likes of you, they must be in a desperate way altogether. Go down and put on that kettle. The next worst thing is to be out in the backyard, filling the kettle from the tap with the moon beaming away, and Kathleen Purcell from next door perched up on the wall looking for her cat. "God, Frankie McCourt, what are you doing in your grandmother's dress?" and you have to stand there in the dress with the kettle in your hand and explain how you washed your clothes, which are hanging there on the line for all to see, and you were so cold in the bed you put on your grandmother's dress, and your Uncle Pat the Abbot fell down and was brought home by Aunt Aggie and her husband Pat Keating, and she drove you into the backyard to fill this kettle, and you'll take off this dress as soon as ever your clothes are dry, because you never had any desire to go through life in your dead grandmother's dress. Now Kathleen Purcell lets out a scream, falls off the wall, forgets the cat, and you can hear her giggling into her blind mother.
Mammy, mammy, wait till I tell you about Frankie McCourt abroad in the backyard in his dead grandmother's dress.
You know that once Kathleen Purcell gets a bit of scandal, the whole lane will know it before morning, and you might as well stick your head out the window and make a general announcement about yourself and the dress problem. By the time the kettle boils, the Abbot is asleep from the drink, and Aunt Aggie says she and Uncle Pa will have a drop of tea themselves, and she doesn't mind if I have a drop myself. Uncle Pa says, on second thought, the black dress could be the cassock of a Dominican priest, and he goes down on his knees and says, "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned." Aunt Aggie says, "Get up, you old idiot, and stop making a feck of religion." Then she says, "And you... what are you doing in this house?" I can't tell her about Mam and Lam and Griffin and the excitement in the loft. I tell her I was thinking of staying here a while because of the great distance from Lam and Griffin's house to the post office. And as soon as I get on my feet, we'll surely find a decent place, and we'll all move on, my mother and brothers and all. "Well," she says, "that's more than your father would do." It's hard to sleep when you know the next day you're 14 and starting your first job as a man. The Abbot wakes at dawn, moaning. Would I ever make him some tea? And if I do, I can have a big cut of bread from the half loaf in his pocket, which he was keeping there out of the way of the odd rat. And if I look in Grandma's gramophone where she used to keep the records, I'll find a jar of jam. He can't read, he can't write, but he knows where to hide the jam. I bring the Abbot his tea and bread and make some for myself. I put on my damp clothes and get into the bed, hoping that if I stay there, the clothes will dry from my own heat before I go to work. Mam always says it's the damp clothes that give you the consumption and an early grave. The Abbot is sitting up telling me he has a terrible pain in his head from a dream where I was wearing his poor mother's black dress and she flying around screaming,
"Sin, sin, 'tis a sin."
He finishes his tea and falls into a snore sleep, and I wait for his clock to say 8:30, time to get up and be at the post office at 9, even if the clothes are still damp in my skin. On my way out, I wonder why Aunt Aggie is coming down the lane. She must be coming to see if the Abbot is dead or needing a doctor. She says,
"What time do you have to be at that job?"
9.
"All right."
She turns and walks with me to the post office on Henry Street. She doesn't say a word, and I wonder if she's going to the post office to denounce me for sleeping in my grandmother's bed and wearing her black dress. She says,
"Go up and tell them your aunt is down here waiting for you and you'll be an hour late. If they want to argue, I'll go up and argue."
Why do I have to be an hour late?
Do what you're bloody well told.
There are telegram boys sitting on a bench along a wall. There are two women at a desk, one fat, one thin. The thin one says,
"Yes?"
"My name is Frank McCourt, miss, and I'm here to start work."
"What kind of work would that be now?"
"Telegram boy, miss." The thin one cackles.
"Oh, God, I thought you were here to clean the lavatories."
"No, miss. My mother brought a note from the priest, Dr. Cowper, and there's supposed to be a job."
"Oh, there is there? And do you know what day this is?"
"I do, miss. 'Tis my birthday. I'm 14.
"Isn't that grand?" says the fat woman. "Today is Thursday," says the thin woman. "Your job starts on Monday. Go away and wash yourself and come back then."
The telegram boys along the wall are laughing. I don't know why, but I feel my face turning hot. I tell the women, "Thank you." And on the way out, I hear the thin one,
"Jesus above, Maureen, who dragged in that specimen?"
and they laugh along with the telegram boys. Aunt Aggie says,
"Well?"
And I tell her I don't start till Monday. She says my clothes are a disgrace, and what did I wash them in? Carbolic soap.
They smell like dead pigeons, and you're making a laughingstock of the whole family.